That was a good start. This podcast of Word of Mouth is supported in part by Doucette Survey.
Nice.
Doucette Survey, serving your professional land surveying mapping needs in New England, now with offices in New Hampshire and Maine.
There's more information at doucetsurvey.com. We could do it like robots.
Word of Mouth Daily Podcast, sponsored by Doucette Survey.
Word of mouth.
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 This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. The history of the world is but the biography of great men, wrote Thomas Carlyle in the 19th century. Joshua Wolf Schenck is not having it. He argues that the myth of the lone genius neglects and obscures the primary creative unit that has moved us forward. Pairs. Marie and Paul Curie, Larry David and Jerry Seinfeld, Steve Wozniak and Steve Jobs, Mark Zuckerberg and Sheryl Sandberg, and the duo behind this song, John Lennon and Paul McCartney, are among the imaginative couplings covered in Powers of Two, finding the essence of innovation in creative pairs. Schenck uses their stories to explore what he calls the electrified space of creative partnerships and the essential ingredients in creative pairings that have produced the most imaginative, world-changing ideas and works. Joshua Wolf Schenck, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Hi, thanks for having me.
That song, I Get By With a Little Help from My Friends, it's thematic, of course, for what we're talking about, but also reveals a lot about how John Lennon and Paul McCartney worked together. How did this song come about?
It does reveal a lot. They had a lot of space from each other at this time. They lived about an hour away from each other, starting in the mid-1960s. John was in the stockbroker belt about an hour outside of London, and Paul was right in the thick of London. And John was spending a lot of his time tripping on acid and reading mystical texts, and Paul was hobnobbing around London with the best and the brightest. But they met most afternoons around 2 o'clock, and this particular afternoon they were down at Paul's place and started at 2 o'clock and banged around on the piano and with guitars and just ambled their way through the whole afternoon. It was about 7 o'clock when they decided to head to the studio. They wrote maybe 4 or 5 lines in that time, and you see them playing off each other and delighting in each other and challenging each other, and also just being in this totally safe and open environment out of which the song emerged, that is a song so much about connection and friendship.
Yeah, it's so interesting because you portray them in the book as very opposite, that John is disorganized and kind of ambling around, always has to have somebody nearby in the studio with him, whereas Paul kind of sits quietly chirping away and writing in his neat handwriting. They're almost
right.
Like opposites.
Every pair has this kind of dialectical, you know, opposition, and you see people who are almost like from a different species. They're so strangely matched, and yet there's also always an undercurrent of profound similarity, and that might sound like a truism because everyone is like another person and also very much dislike them. But you see in great creative pairs, these two things happen to extreme degrees. And the oppositions are really essential because that's what allows people to find their niches. That's what allows people to expand the other's mind. It also then leads to a kind of undercurrent of tension, which is there from the beginning, where you're not going to be perfectly comfortable with someone with whom you're creating. And a lot of times it's the opposite of comfort. There's just it's almost like getting an electric shock. When Larry Page and Sergey Brin first met, they would go on to found Google together. They met at graduate school in Stanford, and they immediately broke into an argument, and they argued all afternoon. And a journalist described them as like two swords sharpening each other, which I think is a beautiful image for so many of the pairs.
Well, that tension, that distance really served the collaboration between the great choreographer George Balanchine and his longtime, what shall I call her, obscure object of desire, the ballerina Suzanne Farrell. What was going on there?
Well, yes. And, you know, it edged into eroticism, which is often the case, too. And we think, oh, well, you're talking about sex. But eroticism and sex are two very different things, even though we associate them together. Eroticism is this intense physical, but also spiritual yearning to be near someone, to be drawn to him or her. And it often is an element of creativity, and it can run underneath a lot of great work. It also can get tricky, as it did for George Balanchine and Suzanne Farrell. He longed for her in ways that went beyond their work. And she, as a much younger woman, stood up to him and said, no, our relationship is about work. And I'm not going to give you what you think you want, which is to have sex with me, because what we both really want is to do this work. And it is a great drama. It really is, like many of the stories in this book, almost, you know, these sort of archetypal myths of conflict and struggle and the achievement of great beauty, but alongside a lot of tenderness and difficulty.
And it wasn't what it seemed. Suzanne Farrell said that the relationship was never consummated sexually. But we may have this assumption of Balanchine in charge of his teenage dancer. Tell us about the kind of bonds that you found inside of these creative pairings. And, you know, who was in charge, or was, did somebody right. have to be?
That's a great question. You know, power dynamics and power struggle is a big part of creating. And you do often see a dynamic like Suzanne Farrell and George Balanchine, where he is clearly the boss. It was his company. And yet, by letting this woman into his life and into his heart, by turning to her for her interpretive choices, he became dependent on her. It's often the case when we see someone in the spotlight, we see Valentino, the great designer. Mm-hmm. We don't know that he's actually being directed by someone who is off stage and unseen.
I love the quote from Valentino of his creative partner, Giancarlo Giametti. He says, living all of his life next to me, he accepted the role that was reducing. But there's a saying, when two men ride in the same horse, one has to be in the back.
It's a great quote, and it's these stories are fascinating psychologically, because Valentino does seem to really believe that he is certainly that he is primary, and on some level that he is doing it alone. And one of the things that Giancarlo does for him is sustain that illusion, and that is often the case, you know, with these hidden partners. But it really gets problematic when they are written out of history, which is so often the case. You know,
well,
we know about.
That's my question. Yeah. I mean, there's a suggestion here that we need another. You know, someone, as Albert Einstein said of Michel Besso, to be a sounding board, a mirror. But should we be minting new Susan B. Anthony dollars with Elizabeth Cady Stanton's profile on there too? Should we revise our thinking about who gets credit?
I mean, that you've just cited one of the most outrageous examples of how credit goes to a singular person. And we see it all the time when the MacArthur Foundation announces its fellowships in academia, when someone is up for tenure and they have to demonstrate a singular original contribution and create this fantasy, this fiction that they've done it shorn of intense entwined collaboration, which is almost always the case in the sciences. What we see all through history are these enmeshed relationships. It's not the lone genius, and it's also not the kind of hive mind and, you know, we're all just, you know, in a big group kind of making each other smarter. It is passionate, aroused, electric relationships that have all the dimensions, you know, of our great romances and our great friendships, and they're dramatic and they're heartbreaking, and that is where creativity happens, with relationships.
Chemistry and tension and distance and confluence, some of the elements of great creative partnerships, at least as described by our guest, Joshua Wolf Schenck. He's author of the book Powers of Two. Another element, Joshua, romance, because indeed some of the creative pairs you cover are couples. Artists Christo and Jean-Claude, Maria Abramovich and Ule, Marie and Pierre Curie, who would not be known for discovering plutonium and radium if they had followed their own paths. So what was the advantage there of joining together?
There's a great love story. And Pierre was a loner. He was living with his parents in his mid-30s when he met this young upstart, this brash Polish woman who was fiercely independent and had her heart broken. She also had a lot to prove as a woman scientist, and she really wanted nothing to do with him, but he pursued her and he beseeched her not just to join him as a wife, but to join him as a partner and to set aside her separate interests. She was a nationalist and very political and insisted on returning to Poland. And he said, "No, you and I can do something very beautiful together." And in his mind, the science and the love for her person were really totally entwined. And that's how their career unfolded. They got married. They began to do their research. And it was actually quite separate to begin with. But then when she got on this thread that led her to discover radioactivity, he abandoned his independent research and became joined with hers. And they began to write in journals with entwined hands. And everything was first person plural from then. It was all we. There was no I.
Hmm.
One thing to pay attention to in our own lives, that moment when you talk about something as being ours, and it may not feel unambiguous. It may feel like, well, I'm actually not sure if this is mine or ours or yours. But if you find yourself in that space of not knowing, that's a great sign that you're beginning to truly partner with somebody.
That sounds like a great give and take, a great relationship. But some of the relationships you're writing about are not particularly good relationships.
Yes, well, we have to redefine good around creativity. Good relationships for innovation and making new and beautiful things is when the work is outstanding. You may have two people who quite dislike each other, like Penn and Teller. They had a great deal of respect for each other, but they also had a kind of cold, clinical relationship, and they did fight a lot. John Lennon and Paul McCartney also had a great deal of tension and competition and might go from being best mates to being in a kind of tug of war, as their producer said. But all those varieties of emotional experience, you know, fueled the work that they did. And these relationships are really critical. And I think they also really help us see friendships and romantic relationships in a new light, because a lot of times what's most satisfying in these relationships is what we do with one another, not just how we make each other feel.
Well, Josh, why then does it persist, this kind of myth of the lone genius? Why do we gravitate toward that?
Creativity is ethereal. It's mysterious. We're trying to tell a story about it. And the lone genius makes for a very clear, simple story. You know, it meshes with the hero's journey, and we can really track it. It also functions very neatly in a market economy. You know, who owns it? That person owns it. But it's just gone way, way too far. And we need to bring relationships out of the shadows and into the center. And as we do, we need to recognize that there's a great deal of ambiguity and complexity. And anyone who has been in an intense, intimate relationship, whether it's romantic or creative, knows that it's something intensely private. No third person is going to fully understand what happens between you. And a lot of times people say, okay, well, I'm not even going to try to understand what happened between George Lucas and Marcia Lucas. I'm just going to say that George Lucas was the great lone genius. And that's not true. And it's really, really harmful for people who are trying to make work themselves. If they hold themselves up to these just inane standards that are never the case when we look at the people we admire and how they did what they do.
Well, Josh Schenk, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me. It's been fun.
A crowd of people turned away, but I just have to look, having read.
Joshua Wolf Schenk is author of Lincoln's Melancholy and now Powers of Two, Finding the Essence of Innovation in Creative Pairs. You can find more on the book, including a link to an article he wrote on the Lennon-McCartney Creative Partnership for The Atlantic. That's on our website, wordofmouthradio.org. And we would love to hear from you. What are some of the greatest creative collaborations of all times? Think Patti Smith and Robert Mapplethorpe, Frida Kahlo and Diego Rivera. Tell us what we missed on our Facebook page, facebook.com/wordofmouthradio. For anyone who's ever blinked in a photo or just made a really weird face, help is on the way. Up next, we're going to hear about Auto Awesome. It's a new Google feature that combines the best of disparate photos into one perfectly gorgeous and completely fabricated moment. That's when Word of Mouth continues.
Way upstairs and had a smoke, and somebody spoke, and I went into a dream.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Say cheese! If you've ever been behind the camera for a family photo, you know that there's always somebody blinking or not smiling or making a silly face when you take the shot. Digital photography allows us to take countless versions of the same shot, but you still have to go through all the rejects and pick the best one, right? Not anymore. Enter Google's default photo feature, Auto Awesome. Now a computer can not only pick the best shot, but also combine photos into one perfect moment, one that never actually existed. Our next guest thinks that's not so awesome. Robert Elliott Smith is a teaching fellow at University College in London. He's in the Department of Computer Science, and he wrote an essay on his blog called It's Official, AIs Are Now Rewriting History. Robert, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Nice to be here.
Describe your experience with Google's Auto Awesome.
Well, it all started when we were in a little bistro in France with my father-in-law, who's not very good with little devices. And I handed him my iPhone and said, take a picture of me and my wife. And he held down the button for a long time. It took about 24 pictures or something. And when I got home, I was uploading them into an album, and I decided my wife might like one of them. She might like the other. So I uploaded just two from that burst of 24. And then a few hours later, I got an email from Google saying, Auto Awesome has done some Auto Awesome things to your photos. So I went and looked, and it had done some nice kind of Instagram-like filters and things here and there. But there was this one strange picture that had in the corner, it said smile with some little sparkles around it. And I looked at it, my wife looked at it, and we couldn't figure out what was strange about it. And then I went back and looked at the two originals and found out that neither one of them were actually the photo that I was sent. And in fact, my wife's smile had been plastered on a different face. From a different picture, and effectively it had married together two different smiles from the both of us, which I found awesomely creepy.
It does sound a little creepy, I have to say. How does this algorithm actually work?
Well, I imagine what it does, and I have to imagine here because I'm not at Google, but I imagine what it does is it basically looks for photos that have almost all the pixels in common, and if it finds those, then it says, can I find any smiles in these pictures? And then it looks at all the things that look like some template of smiles. And then it basically says, well, take all the best smiles from all of them and put them all in the same photo.
Where did you upload this again that Google sort of took it upon itself to auto-awesomate your photo?
Google Plus upload of photos to its photo area.
Okay, well, that makes sense. Well, you do mention in the essay, however, Robert, that cameras have always been a fictitious view of the world. What makes Auto Awesome creepier or different?
Well, in my opinion, there is a difference between this and, say, adjusting the white balance in your photos. Because although white balance is not ever the way it really is in real life, the smile is like a symbol. The smile is like a fundamental symbol. It's something that we all kind of use to understand one another, and it's probably the most fundamental part of human communication is the facial expression. So effectively, now what's happening is without the designers of the algorithms really being aware of it or the photographer being aware of it, the computer is going and basically rearranging the facial expressions. And I think that's slightly different than just adjusting parameters of the photograph.
How about the results, though? Your wife like her smile in the photograph? I mean, how did you guys look?
We both look fine. Our faces, looking at the photo itself, were probably a little creeped out. But in the photo, we looked fine. But, you know, I think the more troubling thing is that I'm sure that there are photos that Google may be automatically rearranging that aren't really meant to be rearranged, where having a smile is kind of inappropriate. I can imagine that a smile being put on in just the wrong moment might be a bad thing.
Mm-hmm. So this rewriting of history, it all looks a lot smilier.
Yeah, but is that really what we want? We all want a happy, smiling picture of every moment we've ever photographed.
Yeah, and in the future, nobody's going to know the truth of that.
Yes, and I saw Gone Girl over the weekend, and
I was thinking
smile,
of exactly the same yes. thing. So describe the scenario, if you would.
Well, in Gone Girl, one of the worst moments that happens is that the troubled husband, when his wife is missing, basically is giving the nervous speech you give when you're in front of a big crowd of people and the police and that sort of thing. And somebody from the crowd yells, "Give us a smile," and he smiles. And then that photo, of course, appears in the newspaper, which makes him look completely like a creep.
Well, I'm assuming your wife is not going to disappear in any time.
I'm hoping not. And if she does, boy, this interview is going to sound really, really strange.
So have you turned Auto Awesome off?
No. I kind of like to see what these things do. So I'll continue to let Auto Awesome do even more strange things to my photos in the future, I'm sure.
Well, we'll look forward to seeing them, Robert.
Well, it's been nice talking to you about it.
Robert Elliott Smith, teaching fellow at University College in London. He's in the Department of Computer Science. He wrote an essay on his blog called "It's Official, AIs Are Now Rewriting History." And you can read it and see those photographs for yourself at wordofmouthradio.org. If an otherwise good photo is looking a little drab, maybe you just need to amp up the color. What exactly does that mean? And what makes a color? Word of Mouth finds out after the news. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. A single question can be a powerful, motivating force. It can open up entire fields of study. It can take a person over, shaping who they become. And it can jump inside of other people, too, infusing them with a burning curiosity. Reporter Ari Daniel has the story of just such a question. What makes a color a color?
Our story begins in downtown Atlanta, in a park no bigger than a tennis court.
Standing here, you are looking at an uncountable field of daffodils.
Dabney Dixon works just around the corner.
So I was walking by here yesterday, and I go, whoa, I wonder what specific molecule makes it that beautiful color yellow. Carotenoids.
By the way, Dixon's a chemist at Georgia State University.
Like music in the background, I can envision the molecules that make the color of our world.
Knowing how molecules paint color onto the world is deeply gratifying to her. But back in Dixon's office, she says for a while, all she had was the question.
When I was a little girl, I would say, what makes things colors? And people would say, well, Dabney, molecules make things colors. And I would go, yes, yes. But what makes a blue molecule, and a green molecule? And I never met the people who knew the answer. And then I got to college, and I took freshman chemistry, and I went, I met the people who know what makes different molecules different colors. And so I went and became a chemistry major, and here I am all these years later.
The answer has to do with how molecules interact with white light, which contains all the colors of the rainbow. Each molecule absorbs different wavelengths of light, pulling colors out of that rainbow. The leftover colors, that composite, is what we see. Now Dixon gets to work with color all the time in her lab. It makes her work a lot easier because she can see where her molecules are when she's running her experiments. Her molecule of choice is heme.
Heme is what makes blood its bright red color.
Heme is found inside hemoglobin, the protein in red blood cells that transports oxygen from your lungs to the rest of your body. It's a flat arrangement of atoms.
It has four nitrogen atoms in the middle, and those nitrogen atoms each hold on from four different directions, kind of north, south, east, west, to an iron atom in the middle.
Dixon studies bacteria, like the ones that cause strep throat, that consume the heme in our blood. Ultimately, they're after the iron, which they need to digest their food.
You don't think that there's much blood in your mouth, but tiny little cuts, there's enough blood to keep the Streptococcus bacteria happy and provide enough heme out of the hemoglobin to let the bacteria live quite handily.
Dixon's question these days is how a bacterium manages to get the heme from outside its cell to the inside, which for a tiny molecule is a long distance. Here's an analogy.
Let's imagine that we have a game that's a combination of ultimate frisbee and basketball. So the frisbee is the heme, large flat entity, and it's got a little bit of iron in the middle, so we'll tape a tiny little magnet to the middle of the frisbee. People are going to throw the frisbee one to the other, And then when it gets to the end, you need to get the frisbee down into the basket.
Bacteria have proteins embedded in their cell membranes, and the heme gets passed from one protein to the next, kind of like players tossing the frisbee down the line. The heme enters the cell when it passes through a channel, the bacterial equivalent of the basket.
Then it's destroyed by other proteins in the cell. They're basically going to throw the frisbee away because they just want that tiny little magnet. They want the iron.
Dixon wants to know how these bacterial proteins, some of which are totally unlike any proteins that have been described before, hold onto the heme, and how their shape changes when they release it to the next protein in the sequence. Understanding this and eventually tampering with it might lead to new antibiotics. And the fact that heme is red not only makes doing this work easier, it goes back to Dixon's lifelong love of color.
I get to see the beauty every day in the lab.
And Dixon doesn't keep her passion for color and chemistry to herself. She takes it on the road. Dixon stands in front of a class of third graders at the children's school in Atlanta.
We're going to show you pictures of molecules and atoms.
Dixon flashes a series of molecules onto a big screen. Different colored spheres, which represent the atoms, pop into view.
It looks like a bunch of sprinkles.
Looks like a hairball from a cat.
This molecule happens to be hemoglobin. At the end of the class, Dixon asks her two undergraduate helpers, Ariel Hackle and Stephanie Thompson, to field questions.
What made you want to be a scientist?
I always asked a lot of questions, and I wanted to find some answers, and I just felt like being a scientist was probably the best way to do that.
When I was your age, I loved science, and I knew that when I grew up, I wanted to be a scientist. Does anybody want to be a scientist when they grow up?
Yeah.
Awesome.
Half the class.
Don't ever let it go. Go for it.
Their professor, Dabney Dixon, didn't meet a chemist until college. Now she's determined to meet as many kids as she can and introduce them not just to chemistry, but to a world full of colorful questions. Our series, Small Matters, is produced by the Center for Chemical Evolution and sponsored by the National Science Foundation, with additional support from NASA. I'm Ari Daniel.
Well, we're going to take you from color in the molecular lab to color on the catwalk. Up next, we continue our series Good Gig with the executive director of the Pantone Color Institute. We're going to find out what it's like to determine color trends for a living. That's when Word of Mouth continues.
Word of Mouth.
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 This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Just as New York Fashion Week kicked off in September, Pantone announced its colors of the year for spring 2015, making 2014's Radiant Orchid so last year. The company that standardized color reproduction in the 20th century is now the global authority on color for designers and paint manufacturers and fashion's faithful hordes. We have deep-seated associations with color. Think of the indigo dyes that drove trade in the ancient world, the woman in the red dress, Iran's Green Revolution. The fashionable colors worn throughout history represent more than fads. They project mood and meaning and culture and context. A new book tracks fashion's richly shaded marriage with color for the past 100 years. Leatrice Eisman is executive director of the Pantone Color Institute and co-author with E.P. Cutler of Pantone on Fashion, A Century of Color in Design. Leatrice Eisman, welcome to Word of Mouth.
It's delightful to be here.
So what a job, a life in color. Is this something you've always been drawn to?
Absolutely. I mean, those of us who are drawn to color know that, and you recognize that it started very early in your childhood, where every kid has enjoyment out of playing with crayons. But for me, it was more than that. It was like an addiction. I had to repaint my room every other year, repaint the furniture in the room. even adults would come to me and ask my opinion about what colors to use together. So it's you know, for anybody who's into color, they completely get it. They can't remember a time when they weren't deeply involved with color.
And you continue to be deeply involved with color, and I'm dying to know about this whole choosing of the color of the year. I mean, is there a conspiracy here? Do you get a secret message from Anna Wintour or Miuccia Prada or Karl Lagerfeld to meet in a cabal and decide what it's going to be?
No, it's not anything like that. I mean, I think there are some who like to believe that, you know, we all have this secret meeting together. But it doesn't work that way. We at Pantone really do our homework in deciding on the color of the year, in that we have to look at many aspects of color. Most importantly, the zeitgeist. You know, what is a feeling that's out there afoot with consumers, with the average person on the street? We have to travel the world, literally looking at influences from all over the world. We look at what movies are in the production line. Is there a color story that's involved with a particular film that's going to get a lot of attention? We look at the world of art, certainly. Is there a big collection that's going to be going around the world? Is it getting a lot of attention? What is the artist that's involved? We look at even sports events. Is the Olympics going to be held in a specific year? What is the host country? What are the team colors? We certainly look at the fashion world because that's hugely important. And at Pantone, we do have a leg up in that we ask the designers to send us illustrations in and of a given season well ahead of time. And then the symbolism of the color is hugely important. What does the color say? You know, what is the psychological message that it gives, and that is that appropriate for a particular time period?
So some predicting, some reflecting, a lot of reflecting, not dictating, which is interesting. You're not telling people what they're going to be wearing. And by the way, what are we going to be wearing in spring 2015?
Well, we see that the mood in spring is definitely one of a kind of a cool, calming, quiet zone, as we call it. We have the four top colors all being in the cooler color family, starting with the aquamarine.
Mm-hmm.
Interestingly, scuba blue comes second to that, which is a little bit more vibrant than the aquamarine. And then a color that really has its roots historically going way back, a color called lucite green, which is almost a see-through color. That is, the name implies that it has this very clear, translucent feeling. And we're seeing a lot of that color for spring of next year. And then, of course, there's always the classic blue that absolutely never goes away. Everybody owns something in a classic blue for springtime and summer. And so that's number four. That's not to say that we won't be seeing some warm shades in the spring. Colors like tangerine or custard or even strawberry ice, even though it has a name that implies that's very cool, still has a degree of warmth that's attached to it. So it's a very interesting palette, but led by cool colors for spring of 2015.
I'd love to get to the names, because for one thing, when you're doing this historical survey back to the early 20th century, color was not always apparent in black and white photographs that were used in fashion magazine for much of the 20th century. So where do you find the material speaking of something as specific as color, especially when they're not named as we might name them?
If we look back through the ads, we found that there were catalogs. Even Vogue put out a wonderful fashion publication, not like the Vogue of today, but very elegant. And in the 20s, I found a yellow-green shade that just, I could not believe that this very citrusy, very contemporary-looking color was even available to anybody in the 20s. So it's a learning experience for me, too, as I delve back through the historical aspect of fashion. And that's one of the most fun things about doing this kind of book.
I'm glad you mentioned that about not even knowing that people would wear this color at this time. Because in the introduction to the book, you write about the democratization of color that began in the mid-19th century. What was going on?
Well, it was technology, really, because we know, if we go back really a long time ago, purple was the color that was meant only for royalty. Well, the real reason why the royalty and the, you know, the people who had a lot of money wore purple and the common person didn't wear purple was all about the economics of purple. Purple was not available as a dye unless you had access, as they did in ancient Phoenicia, to hammer these tiny little mollusks open, get the juice, the extract of those little tiny snails, and accumulate that so that you could dye an entire garment. Well, you can imagine that's pretty labor-intensive. So as a result, only the wealthy could afford to pay for such a garment. Whereas, you know, coming up to the last century, even a little bit before that, purple dye was accidentally discovered in a lab where they saw that this color could be made, and it could be made for far less money. And so literally the average person could then afford to buy a purple dress. That's what I meant by democratization.
So you also write about what color has come to mean through the ages. Black, of course, the color of mourning for the Victorians. Red, the color of blood and fire and fertility and the life force traditionally. How does color work on us? I mean, it actually stimulates our brain.
No, there's no question of that. There's the psychological and the physiological effect of color. If you can imagine going back to the beginning of time, if ancient people saw, you know, bloodshed or the color of fire, they attached the feeling of danger. I mean, red was something that could not be ignored. It had to be looked at. Now, after centuries of being implanted with that idea, that concept, we know red enters our field of vision. We can't avoid looking at red. Our eye automatically will go to it. Now, it could be a warning signal. Again, it's a red stoplight. There's sexual excitement that comes into play here, too, the red lipsticks. So that there's a various applications of the color, even though, if you go back to the beginning of time, it usually was some connection with color as it appeared in nature. Another example I can give you is sky blue. Why is it that any place in the world, if you show people a little Pantone swatch of sky blue, they will invariably say, oh, it's such a peaceful color. It's so serene. It is a dependable color. It's loyal. These are the kinds of words that we get back in color word association studies that we conduct.
That's why I'm told that politicians wear blue ties.
Exactly. Exactly. That is exactly the message that they want to give across. So, you know, we see that color can be manipulated. People will wear it for specific reasons to give certain messages because they know that most people will regard that color the same way.
Color also gives us a sense of time, like what I like to call that 1930s kitchen green, you know. And there's this bright marigold now associated with Hermès that kind of had its day in the 40s, we read in your book, brought back much later by Carolina Herrera.
Yes.
So how do these colors cycle back? What do you think is going on in our history that brings them back around?
Well, there's numerous reasons for that. But if a color hasn't been prominent for several years, if you do bring it back, and the best example I can give you is avocado green, anybody who was alive in the late 60s and 70s knows that it was used in every plush carpet, in every dishwasher, because that was the all-pervasive color at that time. And you had a different mindset in those days. You had people who really did slavishly follow what everybody else was doing.
I want to pick up something I dropped because you just reminded me of it again. The color names that you come up with at Pantone, you know, blue iris, lavender fog, rose wine, glacier gray, opal, hemlock. Wonderful, wonderful names. How do you do this all together in your secret cabal?
Well, there is kind of a secret cabal that does that. And we do it really because with Pantone, you know, we have over 2,000 names that already have colors. So it gets more and more challenging as we move forward. So you have to be considerate of certain elements. Like if you name a color that is just too timely at a specific time, you know, I can remember when we were doing some purples and somebody came up with Barney Purple. And I said, no. We don't know how long Barney is going to be popular. And if that show bites the dust, there goes Barney Purple. So we nixed Barney Purple.
Thank you.
At the same time, thank you for that. But at the same time, there are some beautiful, beautiful names. I mean, you only have to look at flowers and foliage and, you know, places around the earth and beautiful sights to look at that can give you all kinds of inspiration for color names.
So did you buy Mimosa in 2009 or Radiant Orchid? That's Pantone number 18-3224 this year.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, after, you know, I have to. It's part of my uniform. If I'm going to go out and talk to people, which I do all the time, you know, I travel around the world doing presentations, you know, if I'm going to talk the talk, I have to walk the walk.
Well, Leatrice Eisman, I have to ask you, do you just have the best gig? Do you have
I do. I absolutely do. There's no question of that.
Leatrice Eisman, Executive Director of the Pantone Color Institute. She's also co-author of the new book, Pantone on Fashion, A Century of Color in Design. It is a rich experience indeed. There's more information on the book at wordofmouthradio.org.
As an intellectual vibration, smack dab in the middle of spectrum, green can be a problem. That's because there's so many different greens inside of green, and each one has a different IQ. There's the green that should never have happened, the stupid green.
That's a bit of the song Green by Ken Nordine. If his voice sounds familiar, it may be because he's a legend in the voiceover industry, lending his rich baritone to countless commercials, movie trailers, and television and radio programs. But it was Nordine's finesse with the style he called word jazz which drew the attention of an ad agency back in the mid-60s. The Fuller Paint Company wanted to do something a little different with its new campaign, so the agency asked Nordine to write 10 commercials based on 9 different colors, plus all the colors combined, the spectrum.
In the beginning, long before that, when light was deciding who should be in and who should be out of spectrum, yellow was in trouble. Even then, seems that green, you know how green can be, didn't want
the... The commercials aired on the radio for about 13 weeks and then disappeared. Listeners began calling up their local stations, requesting to hear the songs again. But they were commercials, and radio stations weren't interested in giving free airtime to the Fuller Paint Company. For his part, Nordine found the experience of making the commercials so enjoyable, he decided to go back into the studio and record the songs again, removing the Fuller Paint Company tag and adding more colors to the mix. And so the album Colors was born.
Take all the colors under the sun. Only one color I think much fun, and that's orange. Orange, I said, the silly old color who lives next to red. The one that is orangely out of its head, that giggles and titters and rolls.
Ken Nordine based the color's personalities on the music his studio musicians played, giving instructions sometimes like, let's get a groove going, or let's make this one feel a little fat, lugubrious.
Burgundy is fat. Sorry to be so blunt, but that's burgundy. Fat. Burstingly burgundy. So. But also soft. So fatly soft.
For Azure, he requested they play something light, like the clouds, giving Azure a sky blue kind of blues feeling.
As sure as there's Azure, it's true. Azure is bored with just being blue. A fact that has caused our dear friend to act sort of silly, like he's at his wit's end. Azure's as way out as wink. Maybe more out than that. Maybe winkier than wink. You'd never have guessed, but Azure can think of the craziest.
If you'd like to hear more colors and more word jazz, we've put together a Spotify playlist of Ken Nordine's work at our website, wordofmouthradio.org.
Sky blue. Azure would rather, so I've been told, let the sky be a white, upside-down bowl.
Thanks so much for listening today. If you like what you heard, there's plenty more at wordofmouthradio.org. And as we continue our series Good Gig, we would love to hear from you. Do you have a good gig? Do you love it? Do you go to work each day feeling inspired? If so, we'd love to know about it, especially if it's a gig that few people even think of as work. You can go to our Facebook page and tell us what you do, or send a brief email to wordofmouth@nhpr.org and put Good Gig in the subject line. That's wordofmouth@nhpr.org with Good Gig in the subject line. I'm Virginia Prescott. Please come on back for more Word of Mouth tomorrow at 2, right here on New Hampshire Public Radio.
Word of Mouth is produced by
Taylor Quimby,
Logan Shannon,
and senior producer Maureen McMurray.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals
and not those of NHPR,
its board of trustees,
or its underwriters. Word of Mouth is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio.